From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in Washington, D.C., where a transgender woman named Tiara has finally found a place to call home. Tiara is not a native of D.C. She moved to the nation's capital from Zimbabwe after she was abused, harassed, and felt the constant fear of violence. She moved to Washington after learning about its progressive laws and social support for LGBT youth. But like nearly three-quarters of black transgender women in D.C., she was homeless. Homeless youth who identify as LGBTQ face unique challenges. Dedicated beds for this population are scarce, both at the national level and in our own community. And these youth are not always visible. They couch surf, they fall through the cracks, sometimes they become victims of sex trafficking. In D.C., Tiara eventually moved into transitional housing, an apartment run by an LGBTQ nonprofit. This comes after the city stepped up its efforts to help homeless LGBTQ youth, and Rochester wants to follow suit. The Center for Youth is teaming up with local partners to increase the number of beds and support services for homeless youth from the LGBTQ community. We're going to talk about those efforts this hour with our guest, Elaine Spall, Executive Director of the Center for Youth. Welcome back to the program.
Hey, Evan, how are you doing?
Very good. Nice to have you back
here.
Good
to be here.
I wish we were talking about something else.
I know, something fun like Fashion Week. We'll do that in the fall.
Well, I know you will let us know in the fall, as always. Dr. Bill Valenti's here. He is Senior Vice President for Organizational Advancement, co-founder and staff physician at Trillium Health. Dr. Valenti, welcome back to the program.
Good afternoon.
And also here is Scotty Gannett. He's an LGBTQ community leader. Scotty, it's nice to see you here. I see you all over social media, and I felt like I knew you already. It's nice to see you in person.
Thank you, Evan, so much.
Let me just start with Elaine, because I was saying before the program began, you know, how did this get on our radar just in the last few days? Because it's not a problem that just started in the last few days. But Elaine, kind of take me through that. You said you were noticing it organizationally, and then you whether it's in courtrooms or people on the street, the problem started to kind of unfold in front of you.
Yeah, it's one of those things, Evan, which is always sort of present, and it doesn't come to the forefront until everybody starts to talk about it. I'm talking about what we're doing now as a campaign, much like a political campaign. You know, I know how to do those. And we have to start really calling action on this one. So over the last 3 years, we've lost a fair number of youth beds, 18 to 21 year olds, for a variety of reasons. We don't have emergency beds for parenting teens. We don't have emergency beds for older kids. We don't have enough transitional beds. So that's been out there. There used to be more. Two or three agencies who did that before are not doing that now, either for funding or they're moving in another direction or they're going to permanent housing. And we respect that. People have the choice to do that.
Hold on. Do you respect that?
Well, I'm not happy about it, but that's their choice. Okay. It's not my agency. So, yeah, I mean, I understand it. Let me just say that. It would not be my choice. So you have that scarcity there. At the same time, you're getting calls and sends from our courtrooms, our judges, saying, here's what we're seeing, and it's troubling. And we're finding that more and more and more of these young people are on the streets. At the same time, in our Safe Harbor program, we're seeing trafficked young people who find themselves in the most difficult commercial sexual exploitation. A lead story a couple weeks ago by our friend Gary Craig was so shocking and so sensationalized, but absolutely true. So there you go. We have in our community numbers and numbers of young people, men and women, boys and girls, and I'm going to say boys and girls because some of them are as young as 11 years old. That's children out there, and we don't have safe housing. Now, why is it important that we're looking at a designated or dedicated housing for some of our target populations? You know, there just is this sense, and we see it in other cities who do have, Washington and New York in particular, dedicated housing that has embedded in it the kind of support services, social services, medical services, healthcare services, and Dr. Valenti will talk about that, and the other kind of wraparounds that are really needed for this particular dedicated population. We don't have it. We want to have it. We're looking for it within the next 12 months. This campaign is setting us up for that. We call it by their side. Why is that? Well, we don't push or pull. We walk next to people in this path, this adventure. We find that with young people, pushing and pulling, just like our own kids, doesn't usually have the same effect. The Center for Youth is voluntary. We don't mandate anybody, but we know that when we walk next to people, we see some really good things happen. So perfect storm of people coming up, whether it's Trillium or the courts, the DA. I mean, it's pretty remarkable people, our own community policing at City Hall is looking at this as well. So the time is right. The time is now. We're having a call to action.
I mean, here are a couple of the numbers that I admit when I first saw them, I went, no way. And here they are. According to the Williams Institute, and this is a study going back to 2012, 40% of the homeless youth potentially in this country, 40% are LGBTQ.
Right.
And in this community, we reached out. Producer Megan Mack got in touch with a number of people who work assisting people from the homeless population, mm-hmm. just to kind of check in and say, mm-hmm. are you seeing that? Is that right? And Megan Mack, I think I can read Nick's comment on the air here, I think. Nick Coulter is just one of many people
Nick's,
in this community.
Nick's a great guy.
I mean,
yep.
I know you know Nick.
Yep.
And somebody who works very hard on this issue. And, you know, we just asked him, number one, does the data seem accurate to you? He said, yes, he trusts the data. What percent of Rochester's homeless population identifies as LGBTQ? And that question we asked was homeless population, not just youth population. Mm-hmm. He says roughly 20%. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So 20% of the general homeless population, 40% of youth.
Mm-hmm. So, Evan, I don't think you want to make our viewers and our listeners think that you think I'm a hyperbolist. Because
well,
I know we've been...
That's
we've been,
why.
I know.
Because
we've
when
been
I saw
down
those numbers, it was hard to believe.
You're like,
first.
It's Elaine Spall. She's like, you know...
I didn't say that.
I know, but you thought that because you love me so much and you know I exaggerate. But this is not an exaggeration. And thank you to Megan Mack, right? Because it's... But you know what? It is shocking. It is shocking because it's 2018. It's 2018 and we're still there. This is where we are in 2018. Now, we also know that some of our young people are identifying earlier. They're coming out earlier. Mm-hmm. They're taking a risk earlier. They're involved in there's a sexuality that happens a little bit earlier this in 2018 than maybe it did in 1995 or something. So it's not unusual that we have more numbers, younger numbers, mm-hmm. Much more vulnerable numbers. So if you're 15 and you come out, first of all, your parents may not even expect you to be talking about your own sexuality or your orientation. They're just not prepared. So there's a lot of that, I think, the earlier onset of recognizing and identifying. And then, of course, you find yourself really with no resources and couch surfing. And the issue of trafficking, and I don't know if you were able to read Gary Craig's, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The vulnerability of being alone and on the street, and then somebody comes along that looks like they care about you, and in fact, they don't care about you at all, and you become enslaved, and you become really so victimized that it's pretty shocking to read it.
If I could say this, number one, you know, that language alone there, enslavement, that's another situation that if you haven't read about human trafficking, it sounds in 2018 like hyperbole. We're going to come back to that a little bit later this hour because it's not hyperbole.
It's not.
And we'll talk about that coming up here. Dr. Valenti is going to kind of relate with all kinds of issues related to healthcare, risk, vulnerability. And what's the phrase that you like to say? Housing is
healthcare.
Housing is healthcare.
Housing is healthcare indeed.
And so how that relates here. But I want to turn to Scotty Gannett for a couple of reasons. Number one, I remember when I had a high school reunion after a few decades, and there were 304 people who graduated in my high school class in a district outside Cleveland. I remember, and I went back to a yearbook and just kind of flipping through, how many were out? How many were gay? How many were out? I think two when I graduated. Now, at reunions, I mean, there are probably 30, 40 classmates who are
so
who
10%,
are out.
10%?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. But it was minuscule. That just illustrates to me what Elaine is talking about is there's certainly more comfort now to at least come out, to be out with family, with friends, than there was when maybe you were growing up or Dr. Valenti, you were growing up. Scotty's the youngest one here, yeah. I'm sure. But that at least has changed, and I think most of us would say that's a good thing, that we're opening up those doors to embrace who you are and to do that. But when homelessness happens, can you take me through what can cause it? Because not all of the time, even though it's 2018, we think a lot of progress has been made, mm-hmm. it doesn't always go perfectly well. So take me through what causes homelessness in the LGBTQ youth community.
Absolutely. So I think, you know, sure, in 2018 we're seeing kids come out much earlier than, again, maybe back in 95 or even when I was coming out. It wasn't that long ago, but still. And we're seeing more parents, more support, more love for their kids. But I think in some instances, when a kid comes out, identifies as a different sexuality as heterosexual, they're not in that same support system, in that same supportive environment anymore. And so they are either needing to find a safe space or they're being pushed out by their parents. And so then they're searching for an opportunity to survive. And, you know, that's really where the Center for Youth will come in and play that important role in helping those kids in that vulnerable place to help them get their feet back on the ground and thrive again.
We want to believe at this moment that kids aren't being told, you know, you're not welcome here. But it happens.
Absolutely. I mean, we have the numbers that we're looking at from the report, and that's up to 40% of homeless kids identify as LGBTQ. That's a really sad and startling statistic that really shouldn't be happening in 2018, but the unfortunate aspect and perspective is that it is, even here with the numbers in Rochester, you know, up to 20%. So, and with those kids that are identifying as LGBTQ+, you know, they really need a dedicated space to help them.
And so as you look at this issue as a community leader in the LGBTQ community, what's number one that is within reach of changing to make this to make those numbers change, Scotty?
Education, really talking with parents within the school system, outside of the school system, raising awareness like we're doing in this campaign that there is this issue. And I think it really does come back to education and time. You know, I look back to when I came out and my parents weren't exactly the most accepting of that time. It's been over 10 years and time changes people.
How is it now?
Much better. Much better. I was just with my dad over the weekend helping him with some woodworking projects after some arm surgery. So, you know, it's much better now. Time and education and services like these that we're providing here.
I think this is an important moment. As we talk a little bit more about Scotty's story, to try to recognize that as we ask parents not to condemn or cast out, we also, for the families that grow and change, we don't look back and condemn. You know, you're as you say, it wasn't maybe as smooth as it is now.
Sure.
But I don't want to say, well, your parents are, because first of all, I hope they're listening. I hope they're doing great. And number two, you know, change doesn't happen. We don't all get woke at the exact same moment. You know, I'm being a little flippant here, but it's been hard for people, I think, at times who feel like if I'm not as purified as you are, then I'm out. You found out something I said 15 years ago, and I'm sort of not welcome in a movement, or I'm not a good person. And so how do we kind of balance those things to make sure parents feel like your kids are your kids and your kids are great being who they are? With saying, if you came from a family that there was change, that we can look back and we can embrace that sometimes people need that evolution within themselves.
It's very true. I mean, we're talking about different communities that need time to catch up. I mean, that's it happens. It's very true. But, you know, I've had plenty of friends that had parents that were perfectly okay with the fact that their kids are gay or identifying on the LGBTQ spectrum. Time and forgiveness and a lot of love and patience. I remember when I came out and I was talking to my very close friends about my parents and my relationship. They said, you know, just give it some time. It'll be okay. And, you know, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, I did not have that perspective at all, you know. But a decade can change things.
Now, your situation, you know, every person's situation is a little bit different, but for some LGBTQ youth, it ends up being a case where they're either kicked out or they leave because they don't feel support. They may not feel safe or they may not feel loved. Did that happen with you at all?
So, you know, I was not left homeless by my parents because the fact I was gay. It was about a year or two later that I came out to some close family at the time, but it was due to a disagreement. And next thing I knew, I didn't have a home to go to. I was 18 years old, and I remember looking at my silver flip phone at the time, thinking, who can I call to provide me with a bed to sleep on? And about 6 months later, after couch surfing from friend to friend and family friends at the time, my auntie and uncle called me and said, hey, you know, we understand that you're going through this. Come live with us. And, you know, for about 2 years, I was with them, and they really helped me get back on my feet and get me to where I am today. So, but you're left in a very vulnerable position, not knowing what to do, who you can turn to. And sometimes you trust the wrong person. As Elaine was mentioning earlier, you're put in a position where you think you can trust somebody and they may take advantage of you.
Does your own experience help inform the way you look at this work of helping this community now?
Absolutely. Makes me incredibly passionate about what we're doing here. I was talking to Elaine a couple Sundays ago, and I said, you know, this is really taking me back 12 years ago to what was going on at that time. And it's certainly driven me to help and assist in any way I can to get this project off the ground.
For most people listening, homelessness is not something they've experienced, though certainly some. What do you think you want people to understand most urgently about what it is like to be homeless, to not know where you're going to go, to not know how you're going to find a place to be, even if you get that, you said you got kind of a lifeline from your aunt and uncle, but what do you want people to understand about that?
I think the important thing for people to understand is the incredible understanding that when homelessness occurs, that the entire life that this kid, youth, knows has been completely taken away, and they have no idea what to do or where to go. And that hopelessness and vulnerability affects them probably for the rest of their life. And so I think people need to understand that when we're talking about the risks these kids are at, it's because they don't have the world that they knew anymore. It's gone.
I also think, you know, we have to maybe at least keep in mind the way we talk about people who are in the homeless population, adults and children. Sometimes it's easy to assume they made bad choices, bad people. We sort of criminalize it the way we discuss it. Mm-hmm. Is that also part of the community education?
Absolutely. I think that's very true. I mean, these kids didn't make a bad choice. They weren't making bad choices to therefore no longer have a house or a home to go to. They just happened to express and have a different sexuality than their parents. You know, you come home one day and tell mom and dad, oh, I've got a boyfriend. Well, what's going to happen? Are you no longer going to have a place to live? It's not criminal. It's just I happen to love someone differently than you do. And what's so wrong about that? Well, we know nothing. So in that place, in that vulnerable place, they really need support and a guiding hand and a place forward.
Dr. Bill Valenti has been working in our community for, dating ourselves here, a number of years, I would say, Bill.
Yeah.
So as much as I was surprised at the numbers of homelessness among LGBTQ youth, I suspect you were not. What have you seen over the years on this?
Over the years, the problems with unstable housing, those problems have increased. In the early days when I started doing HIV care only, patients came in with their parents, partners, and so on. But as our patient population has shifted to more marginalized people who have less access to health care, we've also, and as they've gotten younger, have also learned that unstable housing is a huge and very significant problem. It's my fifth vital sign, you know, blood pressure, pulse. Where do you live? And that's a question that I haven't asked in years past, only because it needs to be on the radar screen. The problems, though, in terms of health care, limits people's access to preventive care, ongoing care. Because if you don't have a place to store your medicine, or as a patient told me yesterday, I need some help where I'm living because people steal in this house where he lives, people steal his food and his medicine. They sell his medicine and they eat his food. So the issue for this young man is, let's see what we can do and get you out of there, because it's not only a distraction, it's a huge housing instability, huge barrier to ongoing health care. Sexually transmitted infections are a significant problem in young people, especially when they're sexually exploited. We're trying to do this one pill a day HIV prevention thing to manage the HIV epidemic and the epidemic. It stands in the way in terms of access, and what it does is reinforces the stigma of being young, being LGBTQ, and not having access to things that the rest of us take for granted.
I wanted to get to our listeners on the phone, because we have a couple of phone calls, I think, that are really instructive of what's happening in our community. We're talking about the homeless population, particularly the homelessness among LGBTQ youth. And I want to get Kathy and Richard. Kathy and Parenton first up. Go ahead, Kathy.
Well, my husband and I have tossed around, like, you know, could we adopt a child or do foster care or whatever. Every once in a while we'll talk about it. Now, my daughter is, she's still kind of, not, I wouldn't say struggling, but exploring. Is she asexual? Is asexual? Are they lesbian? You know, what she hasn't quite figured it. They haven't quite figured it out. They want to use the pronoun they. They know that, and identifying as non-binary or something. But anyway, we're very, very open to that, and just say, well, you know, you are who you are. We love you, you know, and you aren't your sexuality, but that's certainly a big part of you. So just let us know when you know, you know, and just keep us updated. And so it's a very friendly scene, and her friends are just amazing. These kids, oh my gosh, I never would have even imagined that our world could expand so much knowing these beautiful kids that are, I mean, they're in college now, you know, that visit us and come over, and we just love them. But I do know that a lot of these kids' parents, they have maybe one that is accepting, the other is rejecting. It's a very psychologically difficult thing for a lot of these kids. Some of them are quite suicidal at times. And all of a sudden, but they're all living, that we know, living with their families or at school. Is there a way for us or people to open up their homes to kids that are homeless? I have no idea, and I have no idea if there's psychological services. Anyway, that's actually my question. I wanted to give me my background about it, but yeah.
So you're asking if you can invite someone into your home who is currently homeless?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Kathy's our new best friend. I mean, we love you, Kathy, and thank you so much, because that message is so important. So one of the things that we've been talking about a great deal at the Center for Youth, we need a shelter. We've got something in mind. It needs a lot of work in the state and all that. But we also have what we call TEFs, Temporary Emergency Families, or host homes. One of our questions is, can we expand our host home population so that we find families? It's not foster care. It's not a permanent placement. Some of our kids need 30, 60 days, maybe even less, where they just need to be stabilized while we're finding something more. That's going to be a big push at the Center for Youth. And our board, if you're listening, I'm going to ask your permission first. I'm just saying it. Evan's the first to hear it. But honestly, it has been on our mind so much, because we have people coming forward saying, I can help. My kids are at college, or I'm a single woman with an extra bedroom. So the host home program is absolutely one of the things on our radar screen. Right now, it's less than, it's like a 13 or 14 day stay. That may not be long enough. We've got 5 or 6 families already signed up, but we're looking at what it would take, what it would look like to have Kathy and her husband, for example, and do we know her address? I'm just teasing. But, you know.
Oh, I'm going to get her in touch.
Thank you.
If I can have a telephone number. And I'm sorry, yes. I did just join the conversation, so I don't even address this before. Yeah. But.
No, Kathy, that's okay. I think Elaine is thrilled about that. So if people want to contact the
Center for
Youth.
Please call the Center for Youth. Yeah. Yeah.
What's the number?
585.
Center for Youth?
Right, 585-473-2464. And Kathy, just ask for me. Just start with Elaine Spall, and I'll get you the right people. But this is the example, host home families that are maybe 30 days emergency. You know, and some of our LGBT kids also have babies. And so we need to be able to look for those supports as well.
Oh, I love babies.
There you go.
That's so wonderful. But Elaine, what's your last name? I'm sorry.
Spall, Elaine Spall.
Hey, Kathy, do me a favor. Hang there. I'm going to put you back on hold, and producer Megan Mack will get your information if you could.
Okay,
let's see if I can do this here on the new system.
Thank you.
Nope, I locked it. What did I do? I don't know what I've done.
I'm here.
Okay, well, we're going to put you on hold. Kathy and Parenton, thank you. And if, listeners, if you're just joining us, Elaine Spall is here, Executive Director of the Center for Youth. Dr. Bill Valenti, Senior Vice President for Organizational Advancement and co-founder and staff physician at Trillium Health. And Scotty Gannett is an LGBTQ community leader. Dr. Valenti, she mentioned concerns about suicide rates. Can you hit that point? That's an important one here.
Yeah, a serious problem in LGBT young people. And because some kids just don't see any way out, begs the question of healthcare. The Adolescent Medicine Program, University of Rochester Medical Center, Dr. Catherine Greenberg, Adolescent Medicine Program, includes gender identity medical care, but also mental health care. So this is absolutely essential, and Kathy asked about those kinds of services. So Dr. Kate Greenberg's office, Adolescent Medicine at University of Rochester, is the young people place. And we're expanding our offerings as well, but right now that is the locus of that kind of activity. The idea behind it is with any aspect of healthcare is to try and prevent things before they get a grip. And that's what we do in whether it's a housing, preventing HIV, sexually transmitted diseases, or deal proactively with mental health issues, because there's a system in place to get this care and to try and stop it before it gets too far.
All right, let me, before I grab Richard's phone call, Scotty, you want to respond to some of that phone call? That was a really strong stuff from Kathy.
Very strong. Thank you, Kathy, for stepping up and offering that. I know that the center, if they're able to move the direction, will probably be in touch with you. You know, the idea that there are loving, supportive individuals out in the community that are willing to open up their homes to homeless LGBTQ kids is important and vital. And I'm sure there's a screening process you'd go through. But, you know, I was adopted in foster care before I was adopted. And so, you know, that is a important picture to paint. These kids are in an area, in a position where they need help. And there's loving, supportive people out there that will open up their homes, even for a short period of time, and help them. And that's important and needed.
Well, and here's Don on Twitter saying, isn't kicking a minor child out of the house against the law, abandonment or neglect? Does law enforcement or CPS ever charge those parents or force them to allow the kids coming back home?
So, you know, there's absolutely connections to systems, and a lot of what we see are kids who may end up with PINs or some other. So it, no matter what happens, there's chaos involved. So, you know, we live in a country where the words, there's no place like home, whether, is it, did Dorothy say that when she clicked her heels or something?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's no place, and we, that's like part of being an American, right? There's no place like home. Home is where the heart is. What if you grow up in a place where home is no home, or home is not where the heart is, and all of a sudden you've got shame. On top of everything else, you've got the shame of not being loved and accepted for who you are. Now, we have a lot of young people put out who are not LGBT, by the way, so it's not just, it's just the overrepresentation is what's calling us to action. So, yeah, I mean, you know, in New York State, there's no such thing as you can't get rid of a kid. I mean, you can, but you're not really allowed to, and you can go back, and so you may be responsible for that child if they, you know, wreck a car or steal something until they're 21, but that doesn't change the day-to-day connection, does it? So, right, that's right. And so who would bring the charges against the family? Under federal law, any child over 12 is allowed to seek homeless services without parental consent. That's the law. And so whether it's morally right or legally right, of course, is the issue. But we do see ourselves with many, many, many young people on their own by the time they're 12, 13, 14, 15, certainly by 16. So Don's right. I mean, it's not, it certainly isn't permitted under the law. It happens a great deal. And sometimes there's no place like home. Someplace there's no home. And that's what we're seeing.
Richard in Rochester. Go ahead, Richard.
I wonder which of two directions Dr. Valenti and Elaine would advise for longer-term housing for the LGBTQ teen population today. First, creating dedicated longer-term housing availability within the general population of the same age, coupled with education, counseling, and anti-bullying measures to make sure that those LGBTQ teens are comfortable living there. And the alternative is housing space that would only be available to this population, and therefore will be identified as such, opening up potential issues for safety and freedom from harassment and lack of opportunities to healthfully interact with those who see themselves as different.
Hi, Richard. I know Richard. Hi, Richard.
Hi.
Did I see you last night?
Yes.
I did. I thought so, at council. So here's the thing. What we're talking about is our very – remember, we're talking about small spaces. So one of the things that's very different in terms of youth shelters, we don't warehouse kids. You're not going to have a shelter that's got 40 beds. Our largest homeless shelter that the center runs is 13 beds. We have one that's 6 beds, one that's 8 beds. We really do keep these very small. They're very different. It doesn't mean that you live, work, play, sleep, eat only with only people in that house. What we're talking about is an environment that has a trauma-informed approach, that has a good, strong case management, that is very dedicated to the kinds of interactions that Dr. Valenti and others are talking about in terms of both clinical and medical connections, and that you get these young people ready, maybe after 3 months, maybe after 18 months, but you get them ready to get back into the world. This is not to shield or to, keep kids away, but we find it, whether it's the GEMS program in New York City, there are other cities, bigger cities, that have these models that are very effective, but they're very small programs. They're 6 or 8 beds. You're not going to have a 50-bed shelter. So that's really part of the personalization, the individualization, the environment that is really getting you ready to get back and strengthen you. So I would love to I'd love to talk to Richard more about this, because he's got some really good thoughts about housing and urban development. But, you know, we're just starting. We're just starting this, but we've got to do something more than what we're doing right now.
And Richard, stay there. I want to get our other guests to respond as well. Dr. Valenti, I think on a call with Trillium yesterday, we talked a little bit about different organizations locally that maybe are a little bit more proactive in either working with different populations. I think Salvation Army came up. Can you address some of that?
Right. There are a number of groups that are working together on this in terms of transitional and supportive housing. To pick up on Elaine's comment, the Salvation Army does have a program where young people are housed separately from adults, try and minimize some of the trauma, additional trauma on these kids, as well as the other exploitation kinds of things that sometimes happen in settings like that. So my thoughts, though, are that even with all of these people working together, and there are some housing urban development HUD grants that have come through lately, is that it isn't enough. And that the real challenge to us, I think, is to try and prevent this. That in my world, if you ask the right questions, you begin to get an idea of the instability in terms of housing for some people, and try and work with them to find something earlier and avoid the shelter thing.
Are you aiming this at other doctors, the other medical community, to ask this question?
Well, there are large health clinics in town.
Okay.
Where these kinds of, where the population is such that they have unstable housing. But I wouldn't put suburban practices out of this either, because remember those LGBTQ kids that we're talking about are also likely to live in more affluent suburban settings. So it becomes a part of, it's really changing our thinking in terms of understanding, asking the right questions, understanding, and then knowing where to go for some additional help. And the only other thing I'd add is, in any of these housing programs, I think a medical office, a health office,
yep,
is absolutely
connection.
Critical.
Yep.
That do the care where people are getting their, do the services and the health care where kids are living in either transitional housing or in apartments or other mixed-use places.
Can I have Scott? Go ahead, Richard. Go ahead.
I take it from both each of your replies that both paradigms are doable. The important thing is that there be the counseling and case management
Absolutely.
And guidance available
Absolutely.
At each.
Yes. Yeah. Thanks, Richard.
Richard, thank you for the phone call. That anti-bullying or that sort of that approach within housing settings has got to probably be pretty important considering how high the population of LGBTQ youth is in homelessness. Right, Scott?
Absolutely. And I do want to go back to something we were talking about just a second ago about the different agencies in town that are working with homeless populations. Are all of them completely LGBTQ friendly and open? I know, for example, the Salvation Army, for example, doesn't exactly have the best reputation dealing with LGBTQ kids, and so, or the community as a whole. And so, you know, that's why this particular program is so important, is because it is specifically aimed to provide a service to LGBTQ homeless kids. As far as anti-bullying and other programs that are happening within that shelter and homeless house, I think it's incredibly important, whether the kids are all together or it's a specifically dedicated house, to have the staff trained to use the correct language and pronouns, to have staff trained to deal with bullying when they see it and what to do, have staff trained to identify kids that may be more at risk for mental health issues and refer them to the right provider. So all these programs are going to be necessary. And with agencies partnering up like the Center for Youth and Trillium Health to provide that, it's going to be a unique, powerful partnership.
All right, so we're late for our only break of the hour, and when we come back, our guests will tell you more about their efforts to change these numbers, to change this remarkably high level of homelessness among LGBTQ youth. That is nationwide, as far as we can understand from the best studies that are out there. I mean, it is a very high number. Up to 40% of homeless kids in this country are from the LGBTQ population, and that is reflected here locally. So what could change that? We're going to talk more about the campaign, what the center, what Trillium has planned for that. We'll talk about that coming up here. Read more of your comments that have come in. So we'll get to that after our only break of the hour here on Connections. And let me tell you what's coming up on Thursday. Is tomorrow Thursday? Thursday is the next Connections. Yes, it is the next Connections. I'm trying to remember. I know what's coming up Thursday on the next Connections. There was a clip that went viral of a CNN reporter confronting a woman in Florida about organizing an event. It turned out to be actually organized by the Russians, and she didn't take kindly to it. But our question is how the media interacts with people, what's appropriate, what isn't, and epistemology, how we form our beliefs. That, among other things, tomorrow. Welcome back to Connections. Let me read a comment from a listener who is just remarking on making sure visible resources are there. This listener says, visible resources are vital. Keep in mind that the LGBTQ kids living in rural Western New York and their family kicks them out, well, they run to Rochester because our LGBTQ services are seen as abundant. So being visible matters here. Elaine, what do you think?
Absolutely. You know, we have to be brave and courageous. And one of the things about the campaign by their side is exactly what Scotty and others have talked about. When you have an adult, and maybe it's not a family member, who is walking with you. And, during the break, I said we really want to also focus on some of our transgendered kids, which is another increased population. At one of our largest shelters, we have a 13th bed in a private room so that we are ready. That's a visible commitment. That's an overt commitment to say, whoever you are, as you present, you will have the privacy to be who you are. So those are the kinds of things that really matter. And having, for example, we have weekly workshops, yoga classes. We buddy up with the Out Alliance and with Trillium, and we have these regular events, very visible, run by young people. So you always want to be, the Out Alliance is doing a great deal as well. You always want to be seen as friendly and open, and also learning as you go along. You want to be learning as you go along, because we as adults, many of us straight, are trying to decide what we're going to do for our kids. You better listen to them. They will tell you. They will tell you what they need, and that's a big, hard lesson for adults. People think they know it all, and they know best, and honestly, they don't. So that's the other thing that happens in a lot of agencies. We have a very active youth advocacy group, youth spokesperson. They have a big event on Friday night called Say It Loud. And they're out there telling the message. Like, so we see young people sort of being empowered. It's happening with the LGBT community as well. It's very important. Mm.
Scotty, transgender youth, we've seen much more emphasis and conversation about transgender issues in this country in the last few years, but it certainly seems to at least lag behind. Just I'm thinking of the average set of sort of middle upper class parents, and a child comes out and says, "Mom, Dad, I'm gay," versus "Mom, Dad, I'm trans." Is it lagging behind the acceptance and the understanding in families, do you think?
Absolutely. I think if you look at the race for marriage equality, you know, the focus countrywide was on allowing people of same genders to marry each other. The fight and push for trans rights was certainly there, but it certainly was not included at the same level. I mean, and the awakening up for the LGBTQ plus community to say, you know, hey, the T is not silent in our community. We need to focus on trans rights. And along with that is focusing on visibility and awareness. Just like you said, you know, the average set of parents and their kid walks in one day and says, you know, I know that I was assigned a boy as at birth, a male at birth, but in reality, Mom and Dad, I'm female. You know, that response, that parent's response, Knox, is really going to make or break the relationship with the parents. And if the parents aren't welcoming and open and inviting and saying, you know, that's okay, we'll support you. For example, I know an amazing pair of parents that their daughter, who, you know, assigned female at birth, came to them and said, you know, Mom and Dad, I'm a boy, and came out as trans. And the parents got together with their teachers and principal and healthcare provider and really formed a very supportive, amazing network around this child to let him know that, you know, he's in a safe place and still was loved. And so, but in the instance that they're not, we have this visible approach from the Center for Youth and moving forward, especially with dedicating housing, this place will be open. You know, if kids want to run to Rochester, we're here for you. Mm-hmm.
All right, so before we lose the hour, there's a number of issues that we haven't even touched on yet. I said we were going to come back to trafficking because Elaine was referring to Gary Craig's recent article in the Democrat and Chronicle.
Right.
And it is still an issue that when people sort of start to really explore what's going on in the trafficking world, it can be hard for us to get our heads around that it's happening.
Right.
So Elaine, what's first and foremost when it comes to trafficking among LGBTQ youth? What are we seeing here, and what is reality, even if it sounds like hyperbole?
Well, one of the things that has happened since Gary's article, people will see me and say, is it really? Were these really our kids? Did it really happen here? It's so difficult to believe, and you're talking about dozens and dozens. Here's a man, I hate to even say his name, but Stephen Jones is a defendant who marked these young women with the same tattoo. He claimed them. He owned them. He made them his slaves. And I'm very, you know, you have to watch me because I'm about to rant. But this is the most difficult thing I've seen, that kind of thing where you don't have, and it's not just LGBTQ kids, but those young people who are on the street are very vulnerable and very much alone. You know, Evan, when you think about the alienation of being homeless, most of us can't wait to get home at night. You know, we even if we have jobs we love or we love what we're doing, we love our friends, but you go home and you're home, right? And that's where home is where the heart is. What if you don't have a home? And what if you find yourselves in a very, very unsafe place? So there are people, predators, and we know some of these folks are waiting at DSS, let's just say, where they know there's kids by themselves. We know they may be at bus stations. We know that they're actually looking for where there are kids alone and alienated. These are very, very clever people who have a business going. A trafficker said to someone close to me, one of my staff, you know, the great thing about sex trafficking is you can sell the product more than once, unlike drug trafficking. You can't even bear it, can you? So this is what we're seeing.
Who said that?
A trafficker. Sell the product more than once. So, you know, I'm Italian, I'm about to cry. Dr. Valenti will understand. But, you know, this is a very, very difficult. So we got to talk about this another time. We'll come back another time. But this is a very serious issue. And for our LGBTQ kids, and Dr. V may see this, you have this, you just don't have anybody, right? So all of a sudden you have somebody, and talk about a healthcare risk, Dr. Valenti.
That's the definition of being vulnerable.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's vulnerability.
Yeah. And when you have family members, you know, God bless the parents who say, I'm with you all the way. But when you have family members say, you know, you're going to have to figure it out because you're not going to really fit in here. That's what you get.
What is the, because you wear several hats in this community.
I do.
You know, yeah. Working for Rochester City Council on the government side.
Yeah.
What is the most important step to reducing sex trafficking?
Well, we really are talking about community policing. And about 3 months ago, my colleague Adam McFadden and I, he really sponsored it with the mayor. We really got the conversation going about trafficking. We've been talking with a new deputy chief, Laurent Singletary. We've been talking about really trying to figure out what to do. One of the things we may need to do is have more presence in the courts, standing up with young people in the courts. Our safe harbor laws protects those under the age of 18. We have to make sure that we take the authority of that law and we stand up as advocates. So some of the community policing money may end up in the courts. We've got to be their advocates. Absolutely.
All right. Before the hour's out, a couple more aspects of homelessness that I think is important. And producer Megan Mack grabbed a significant amount of statistics that, again, I will just keep saying this to listeners. Until you really start to understand this, it's hard to believe. But it is true that these things are happening. And I want to ask Scotty Gannett about this next part, which is that we've talked about what happens in families when somebody comes out and it doesn't go well with parents. That's easy to understand. That, okay, that could lead to homelessness because maybe they throw a kid out. Maybe the kid doesn't feel safe. Maybe a young man or young woman or person in the family. I keep saying kids. I mean, as Elaine says, a lot of the times, unfortunately, it's happening at young ages. But whatever the case may be, we can understand that. We have to also keep in mind that harassment, that struggle is happening often in a school setting. This is a 2015 report by GLSEN, where students often face harassment, physical and verbal. It leads to additional challenges. LGBTQ students who encountered high levels of discrimination were more than three times as likely to miss school than students who had not. 66% of LGBTQ students felt discriminated against at school due to their sexual orientation. I'm going to read that again. Two-thirds of kids in the LGBTQ community do feel discriminated against at school. So again, a lot of us feeling like there's been a lot of progress. On a daily basis, the average kid in the LGBTQ community still feels like they're being discriminated against. So there's a lot of work to be done there. And Scotty, the reason I ask this is because if you don't feel like you've got a school environment that is supportive or safe or comfortable, I've got to think you're at risk of homelessness, of taking off, of just hitting the road, of just sort of giving up on it.
Sure. Absolutely. You know, the second safe environment in a kid's life should, you know, obviously home is first, second should be school. And we've seen this in the last week threatened with the shooting in Parkland. And it's not a safe environment all the time. You know, LGBTQ kids aged 10 to 24 are the second leading cause of death and suicide is with LGBTQ kids aged 10 to 24. So think about obviously the homeless rate as well. So if they're not finding a safe environment anywhere in the world that they know, where are they going to go? What are they going to do? How are they going to survive the next day and the next day and the next day? Bullying, of course, is a huge problem. We've seen over the number of years the awareness campaigns that have come out because of kids that were bullied to death. There was the kid in Buffalo, I can't think of his name right now. Lady Gaga sang a song about him, I believe, about the kid that was bullied to death and killed himself and committed suicide. So it's a huge issue. And as open and as inviting of environments at school can be, and the amazing support that can be shown within the school system, it's not always the case for everyone.
Yeah, I think that one of the lessons of these numbers is don't just assume that they're going to find that support at school if they don't get it at home.
Absolutely.
Sometimes, yes, but too often now there's still a feeling of being discriminated against, of being harassed, either physically or verbally. I mean, that's still happening to our kids. And Dr. Valenti, I also want to make sure we talk a little bit about vulnerability because you've talked, that word has come up, vulnerable, yeah. You know, that housing is healthcare and that when you don't have that, there's a lot of vulnerability to, I know you've done a lot of work in HIV, other disease. Why don't you tell me a little bit about what you see as a risk here?
Vulnerable people are subject to exploitation. They are, whether it's bullying or sexual harassment or other things, and it is, I was thinking as you were talking, though, that being well-informed helps reduce stigma. So what's the relationship here? I think that people maybe behave differently once we relieve the stigma of the LGBTQ experience, et cetera, so that it may help people respond more appropriately. And I'll give you my closing shot, mm-hmm. is, you know, exploitation and vulnerability go together. We need to try and disconnect the two. And that there are healthcare is different things to different people in these kinds of situations. So mental health care, critical component. Good old-fashioned social work. We call it case management, but yep. everybody knows what social work is.
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
And then in my world, the world of disease and infectious diseases, prevention and treatment.
You've heard Dr. V say prevention so often.
Prevention.
All right, so we're down to our last minute here. By the way, let's put a name on that. Thanks to producer Megan Mack, Jamie Rodemeyer, the Buffalo.
Yes.
Buffalo. Yeah, so, and thank you, Scotty and Megan, for that. In 45 seconds or less, yeah. Elaine Spall, you know, what is the game plan now? Remind our listeners what you want people to understand about what the Center for Youth and what's happening going forward to address this issue.
So we have an intersection of vulnerability to pick up on Dr. Valenti's, and it's trafficking, it's homelessness, and they cross, and it either starts with homelessness or ends with homelessness, but there's a housing shortage, a housing need, both emergency and longer term, and we've got to get this together, and that's the campaign. It'll take us 6 or 8 months, maybe a year, but we're on it. The host homes and the caller that came in, I've got her number. She has to ask her husband first. I get that. But we are not going to be shy about this. We're going to reclaim our kids. We're going to do whatever it takes. And thank you, Evan Dawson. You are a great champion of these issues. I appreciate it.
Well, it's nice to have you here. Elaine Spall is the executive director of the Center for Youth. And one of our listeners points out as well, our communities sometimes just need an actual address. So where are you located?
905 Monroe Avenue. Come see us. 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. open and 24-hour helpline. You can call us 24 hours and we will answer that phone. A person will answer that phone.
Thank you, Elaine.
Thank you.
Dr. Bill Valenti, Senior Vice President for Organizational Advancement and co-founder and staff physician at Trillium Health. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. B. And our thanks to Scotty Gannett, as LGBTQ community leader. Great having you in studio, Scotty.
Thank you very much.
Tim George, is this your last day for now with us for a little while? Is that for now? Will you come back? Tim George is an outstanding engineer, and I've really enjoyed it. So, you know, our listeners don't get to see that beautiful face. I do. Thank you, Tim. Thanks, Megan Mack, producer. And we'll talk to you Thursday on Member Supported Public Radio.